investigation, someone with a professed dislike of blacks, and a connection to Lisa Littke, Eric's former girlfriend. Thornton is white, and he had a reputation that can best be described as unsavory. He boasted of his affiliation with the Insane Gangster Disciples, a mostly black street gang, and has the tattoos to prove it, 22 in all, one of them a six-pointed star above his heart. A smiling Yosemite Sam on his right forearm has GD, for Gangster Disciple, inscribed on its cap. A gargoyle gazes menacingly from his other forearm. It has a tail in the shape of a pitchfork, also a disciple's icon. When I met Thornton, a couple of years after his first encounter with Reeves, he informed me that he soon planned to engrave a dotted line on his neck. It'll say, "Cut on the dotted line." I couldn't tell whether he was joking. His street name, I learned later, was appropriately Mad Hatter. Of sinewy build, he has a shoulder-length mane of jet-black hair. His eyebrows, thick as a rainforest, make his brown eyes look dark and hermetic. They never wander, never let go. He's hard to read. When he talks of his heroes, Charles Manson and Jim Jones, because of their ability to manipulate others, one can't tell whether he's playing mind games himself, trying to keep others guessing as to his own sanity. Is this guy really crazy? Or is he trying to test your reaction, measure your candor and honesty? One fellow inmate said, "I feel like every time I'm looking at his eyes, I'm looking at the devil." Reeves already knew Thornton. Most of the cops did. Previous to the recent burglary charges, he had been convicted of stealing money and lottery tickets from a mobile gas station for which he received probation. Reeves himself arrested Thornton when he threatened to stab an assistant principal at St. Joseph High School. After he'd been expelled, he and a group of friends lived in one of St. Joseph's marinas, staying on an old cabin cruiser that suffered from dry rot and was parked on land. Reeves suspected the band was responsible for disappearing radios, liquor, and assorted odds and ends from the other boats. On this warm summer afternoon, Reeves, along with Taylor, the sheriff's deputy, greeted Thornton at the jail, where they removed his handcuffs and replaced his jailhouse-issue slippers with sneakers. The jail garb, a drab green outfit, hung loosely from his lanky frame. The three climbed into Reeves's Pontiac Sunbird and drove to Pleasant Street, to the building that had once housed the club. Thornton said he had attended the club the night Eric disappeared. "It was packed," he said. "I didn't really associate with anyone in there. I just went there to get some pussy, to get drunk afterward." He said he recognized Eric from when he attended a program for troubled youth at King Preparatory School. King shared some facilities with McCord Renaissance Center, which Eric attended. Eric, Thornton said, got into an argument with a white girl he was dancing with. Through the din of the music, Thornton couldn't hear what they said to each other, he told Reeves. But it was clear from their facial expressions and their gestures that they were having a disagreement. Eric, he said, slapped or pushed her. Thornton instructed Reeves to drive to the corner, to the top of the bluff at Silver Beach. Here, he said, he had seen Eric and James exchange words. James, Thornton said, was the white girl's cousin, friend, or boyfriend. He wasn't sure which. Eric took off down the bluff as James and two of James's friends pursued him. Thornton, who couldn't identify the other two boys, followed them down the bluff and was met by a friend whom he only knew as Dallas. Dallas is black. Thornton hopped into Dallas's old Bonneville and joined the chase. Thornton said he just wanted to witness the action. This all happened sometime around midnight, well after Eric had broken into Warmbine's car. Eric, with James and others in pursuit, sprinted across the railroad tracks, past the waterfront condominiums, through the knee-high dune grass, to the South Pier, all according to Thornton. Thornton guided Reeves through this route, and the three of them, Reeves, Thornton, and Deputy Sheriff Abbott Taylor, left the car at the foot of the breakwater, where a yellow sign warns in large black letters, "Structure is not designed for public access. Proceed at your own risk." Joggers and lovers, nonetheless, venture out onto the wharf, usually staying near the center to avoid the cold surf. For the more adventuresome, a blue metal railing lines the sides, out to 100 feet or so, at which point the pier drops 3 feet and sits just inches above water level. Here the warning sign shouts, "Caution, this structure protects navigation. Ensure your safety. Use with caution. Keep off during storms or high seas." Thornton told Reeves that James and his two friends chased Eric just beyond this spot, just beyond the end of the blue metal railing, just beyond the warning sign. "James will fight quick and fast, 'cause he knows he can," Thornton said. "He's a fucking brick house. He's huge, 100% muscle. He ain't no gangbanger. He ain't been in no trouble with the law that I know of." Thornton said he knew James only from drinking and partying, mostly on the beach. "I don't hang with no one but gangbangers." He recounted that James and Eric had argued loud enough for him to hear some of what they said, even from where he stood, a basketball court length away. "A lot of fuck yous," is what Thornton remembered. "James kicked him in the head," he said. "Eric was standing. Just brought his foot up and kicked him in the head right where the ladder's at. Eric went right back over a chain. He didn't die an accidental death." "What'd the autopsy say?" "Man, there should be boot marks on his head. There should be bruises." "Did they find bruises?" "He and Dallas, left as soon as he went in, and they went to yelling and throwing rocks at him. We got out of there. We didn't want any part of it. They knew they were going to beat his ass. I don't think they meant to kill him." Such is the story of Eric's death, as told by Daniel Thornton to Jim Reeves and Abbott Taylor, and later told to me, on separate occasions, 3 years apart, the exact same story. There are a few tantalizing asides, which by themselves don't mean much, but together lend some credibility to Thornton's story. Thomas Page, a friend of Eric's who is now in the military, told me that earlier that week in school, Eric had asked him to join him at the club Friday night. "I'm going to meet a female there," he told Page. Could that girl have been Lisa Lidke, his former white girlfriend? Eric's peers said they would wear jeans and high tops instead of the fancier silk pants and dress shoes when they thought they might be going somewhere with a girl, another indication that Eric may have had plans that night. Charles Ash, who danced with Eric in their group The Untouchables, told Reeves that white boys had made threats against Eric and others in the past about dancing with white girls. Steve Green, another friend, told me that sometime in the previous week, Eric had told him he had been hassled by some white guys. Both Lorena Robbins, his former girlfriend, and Bobby Natus, his math teacher and gymnastics coach, said that during that last week, Eric seemed unusually agitated and upset. Could he have been distraught over his breakup with Lidke? Or was he already involved with another St. Joseph girl and was having troubles? In the police report, a number of people mentioned that they'd heard Eric had made a bet about dancing with a white girl, not Lidke, and that a group of white guys got angry with him about the wager. I tracked down Lidke in Missouri, where she's now married to a naval enlistee. She said she was not at the club the night Eric disappeared. "I just barely knew the guy. There was nothing between us except for innocent flirting. I just saw him for a few hours once a week at the club for a few weeks. I really didn't care what his life was like. I wasn't that interested in him. We didn't date at all. She wanted, it seemed, to put distance between herself and Eric. Or maybe it's a matter of semantics, and she didn't, in fact, believe that she and Eric had dated." In her interviews with Reeves back in 1991, Lidke had said, "Well, we weren't necessarily going out. We were just seeing each other. I asked Lidke whether she knew what had happened to Eric. I don't know. I really don't know. I have no clue." Her exasperation with my inquiry was clear. "This is so long ago. I'm happy. I'm married. I don't want to deal with it," she concluded our conversation. Reeves, long before he heard Thornton's account, had questioned Lidke extensively. Lidke said she was at a friend's party that Friday night, that she spent the night with her new boyfriend. She passed a polygraph. Maybe it wasn't Lidke at the club that night. A few remember her being there, most don't. If Thornton's story is true, perhaps the white girl they saw was someone else. A few months before Reeves met with Thornton, he received an unsigned, typed letter. It read, "I am responding at the request of a friend about the murder of a black boy last May 1991. Please look into a young man whose name is Richard Teller, not his real name. He told several people he was involved or knew who was involved with this murder. I do not know if he was fabricating this story to fit in, or if this was the honest-to-God's truth. Richard may be living in the St. Joseph area, or, at this time, may be in trouble with the law. I would rather not state my name. I hope this information will help you in some way." Reeves tracked down Teller, who had served time for forgery, and Teller said that he hadn't known Eric, and that he was willing to take a polygraph. He never did. Reeves believed a story. I spent many months trying to find Teller and Dallas, who allegedly had witnessed Eric's drowning along with Thornton, but could find neither. I always seemed one address behind Teller, whom I last looked for, without luck, at a ramshackle cottage in Stevensville. I did learn, however, that Teller had dated James's sister. Could Teller have been on the pier with James? As for Dallas, I could find no one in the area who went by that name. The only Dallas I came up with was through some sources at the Benton Harbor Police Department, but he was a man 15 years older than Thornton. Reeves was skeptical of Danny Thornton's account. Soon after the guided tour of the South Pier, Reeves said the tale was full of bullshit. There were inconsistencies in the yarn and a few matters that were out and out wrong, lies or just misplaced memories. Thornton distinctly remembered that Eric was wearing a black and red Chicago Bulls overcoat. According to Ruth, Eric had on his green task force jacket. Thornton seems certain of this detail, but memory can play tricks. Thornton says the club was packed that night. A few have agreed, but according to its owner, Chris Adams, and others, it was particularly slow that evening, because it was the season's first good weather and many of the kids were at pre-graduation parties. But the part that raised the most doubt for Reeves was Thornton specifying that Eric was pushed into the river downstream of the Coast Guard station. The body, Reeves argued, could not possibly have drifted 1,000 feet upstream. Despite his misgivings, Reeves returned to talk with Thornton again, 3 times. And as he listened to the story again and again, he thought, Danny seems to be connected some way, like there's a thread of truth in there. He may be repeating something he heard, but I'm open. If I was able to prove what happened to Eric McGinnis, I'd walk into City Hall and tell everyone to kiss my... I'd just walk out. That would be the end of my career. I'd be so elated. I'd leave on a high note. Reeves liked to say his job was to sort out the truth, but he certainly believed in hunches, and his hunch told him there might be something to Thornton's tale. But there was one truth that Reeves was wrong about. The body could have floated upstream. The Hanging, a Tale in One Part. This much is not in dispute. Marcus Cooley, a 21-year-old petty thief, was found hanging by his red necktie in a Berrien County jail cell. It's here where people begin to disagree. During the 4 years I spent visiting Benton Harbor, I occasionally heard murmurs from old-timers about a lynching in St. Joseph. No one had many details, though a few conjured up images, albeit hazy ones, of whites attacking a black church. It happened in the 1930s, I was told, or maybe the 1920s, or maybe it was as late as the 1940s. No one was sure. It was always mentioned in the context of Eric's death. I didn't pay it much mind at first. Most lynchings occurred in the South. Michigan, a fairly progressive state, witnessed one lynching of a black between 1882 and 1934. By contrast, during that same period, Alabama recorded 296, Georgia 478. Moreover, St. Joseph's elders had no recollection of such an incident. The handful of books and pamphlets written on the area make no mention of a racial crime, though, to be frank, there's barely any reference at all in these histories to blacks. That's not to say the history isn't there. Whites have killed blacks before. The stories have passed from generation to generation, over supper or over a beer, on stoops and in parlors, told by grandmothers and by pastors, the narratives shaped and reshaped by people's prejudices and blurred memories and by their own experiences. And while they may not be recorded in history books, they exist just as powerfully and vividly in these oral tales. As David Walker, Benton Harbor's police chief, bluntly told me, facts don't mean shit. Perception is the truth. It is common wisdom that myths help people make sense of the world. Indeed, they may explain the inexplicable. They can serve as a compass to the present, though the navigational forces are neither magnetic nor measure of veracity, but a considerably more variable force which mutates over time according to one's dealings and place in the world. While myths can help us make sense of the incomprehensible, they can also confine us, confuse us, and leave us prey to historical laziness. Lore becomes shrouded in the glow of inarguable fact, Truth, though, is not always scientifically discernible, and even when it is, the prism, depending which side of the river you reside on, may create a wholly different illusion. It's an odd calculus. And so I listened closely and took seriously the distinct but dimming memories of the Benton Harbor elders. A lynching in St. Joseph within their lifetime? Maybe. Marcus Cooley, alias Marcus or Harold Lewis, was running from the law. The authorities in his hometown of Des Moines, Iowa, wanted him for violating probation. He had been arrested for breaking and entering. I don't know much about Cooley, other than that he lived with his grandmother, Artie Lewis, and that he had his troubles with the police. I tracked down a distant relative who, as a kid, remembers hearing stories of Cooley's athletic prowess, including the time he eluded Des Moines police by swimming the width of a local river underwater. That summer of 1934, in the heart of the Depression, Cooley, like many others, headed for Benton Harbor, where he knew he could get work picking berries. The reason I know this much is that, as he was on his way, the South Bend police arrested him for vagrancy, and Cooley told them of his destination. He fled the Indiana City before the local authorities learned he was wanted in Des Moines, but they alerted the Des Moines sheriff that Cooley was headed for the Twin Cities. The Des Moines sheriff mailed his Berrien County counterpart, Charlie Miller, a photo of Cooley, accompanied by a note. "This Lewis will do anything to escape arrest, but doubt if he carries a gun. However, it will be well to watch him closely if you locate him. We are anxious to get this man into custody. We'll extradite if necessary." The correspondence got misplaced and wasn't discovered until after Cooley's death. Sheriff Miller was a glad-handing, free-wheeling, oversized figure in Berrien County politics. At his death, in 1953, his obituary referred to him as one of Berrien County's all-time most colorful political figures. Everyone called him Charlie. A Republican, he won his first of three terms as sheriff in 1932, year of a Democratic landslide. One of the local papers wrote adoringly, "A hard worker when he gets on the job. Charles Miller is clean, honest, fair at all times, and would enforce the laws impartially." Those living in the flats, though, didn't think so. Benton Harbor's black population lived on the swampland along the river. The wooden shanties, many with dirt floors, housed families recently from the south. The neighborhood was like a town to itself. The flats had its own stores, its own churches, its own leaders, and its own gambling. One of its spiritual and political leaders was the Reverend Edward Burrell Williams, pastor of the Union Memorial AME Church. Williams was a new arrival. He had grown up in rural Mississippi and entered the ministry by way of Kansas's Western Theological Seminary. Though a newcomer, Williams immediately became involved in electoral politics and, along with others, was instrumental in steering the county's black vote from the Republicans to the Democrats. Though I can't find any mention of it, I assume that Williams supported Miller's Democratic opponent in the 1932 race for sheriff. Williams was short and sturdy. His square jaw and balding pate made him look distinguished, if not stern. His church was the most prominent African-American institution in the county. And with it as his base, he reached out to the area's youth. He gave boxing lessons in the church's basement. His wife taught piano. Williams was also what some called a race-conscious man. He took positions for President Roosevelt's court packing and fought vigorously for blacks to be included in the county's delegation to the state Democratic convention. In later years, he would return to school and become Notre Dame's first black graduate. Rose Burkett, who was white and now 99 years old, remembered Williams as quite radical, always stirring up racial tension. Raymond Robbins, founder of Robbins Funeral Home and grandfather of Eric's girlfriend, Lorena, described Williams as a Martin Luther King of his time. He continued, "He didn't bite his tongue about anything, including the death of Cooley." In September, shortly after his arrival, Cooley was arrested for stealing a car in Benton Harbor. He was housed at the county jail, located on the first floor of the county courthouse. A few weeks later, Cooley pled guilty to the crime and, while awaiting sentencing, attempted a breakout, as the Des Moines sheriff had presciently warned he would. At 4:30 in the afternoon of October 29th, after being fingerprinted, Cooley, on his way back to the bullpen, bolted. Cooley hurdled a 5-foot fence, sprinted over the bluff behind the jail, and disappeared into the thick underbrush. All available sheriff department personnel, as well as the St. Joseph police and a score of neighbors, scoured the woods in the area around a nearby canning factory and railroad depot to no avail. Cooley, it turns out, waited for darkness, crouching in the corner of a small private woodshed, hidden by tools and cut logs. 3 hours later, the sheriff's department received a report that a truck belonging to a St. Joseph plumber had been stolen. Two deputies spotted it in Union Pier, a beach town at the southern end of the county, 20 miles from St. Joseph. They pulled up beside the truck on the Red Arrow Highway, which ran parallel to the lake, and immediately recognized its driver as Cooley. As they yelled for the escapee to halt and sounded their sirens, Cooley slammed his foot on the accelerator. The deputies trailed the truck and shot twice, blowing out the rear left tire. Cooley lost control, hit a gasoline pump, and flipped. He emerged from the toppled vehicle wielding a 3-pound hammer, ready to do battle, but under the threat of being shot by the pistol-toting deputies, he surrendered. They drove him back to the jail, where they placed him in what was called the insane cell, a small, isolated room lit by a bare light bulb, enclosed by a steel door with a small window.